How's everyone doing? We have an overflow crowd. So we say hello to those of you who are up on the fourth floor as well as those down here in the lower level. And we're thrilled to have all of you come to meet the one, the only, Cindy Williams.
I just saw you, Lucy.
Hi, good afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone.
Well, for those of us of a certain age...
Thank you for that, Lucianne.
I didn't mean to look at you, Cindy.
Well, you did, though, and I accept it.
For those of us of a certain age, meeting Cindy Williams is... Well, it feels like embracing a long-time friend again. She grew up in the golden era of television, enthralled with the Milton Berle Show, Jackie Gleason, Arthur Godfrey time... And years later, she as an actress would have that same impact on legions of us, of all her fans across America, as Shirley Feeney on Laverne and Shirley. Reading her book, Shirley, I Jest. Have many of you had a chance to read this yet? Mm-hmm. Yeah? What did you think? I don't know about the
There'll
rest
be a
of
a quiz.
I don't know about the rest of you, but I could not put it down. She has stories from every facet of Hollywood and beyond, and her sense of recall is just impeccable. You realize that not only is she a brilliant and talented actress, but also a wonderful writer and storyteller. So we're going to get comfortable here.
All right.
And we're going to talk a little bit, and then we'll open up for your questions as well a little bit later on. Cindy, when it comes to Hollywood, you are the complete package. I was so surprised to learn that the modern remake of Spencer Tracy's movie, Father of the Bride, was your idea.
Right.
How did that happen?
Well, I always, when I was a kid, I always watched old movies. I mean, they sort of babysat me. And just a big, big fan of all the MGM films. And so one day, my son was about 3 years old. It was early in the morning, and he woke up, and he wanted to go downstairs and play. And so I took him downstairs into the den, turned the TV on, had him, he was sitting down playing, and Father of the Bride was on, Turner Classics. And I realized that I had read the day before that... Ted Turner had acquired the entire MGM film library. So he owned the rights to all these marvelous movies. And I thought, and I was watching it. It was one of my favorite movies. And I was watching it, and I thought, wow, this is like a big film version of a situation comedy. It's across the boards delightful for everybody. I mean, there's just not, like, no one... left out, and it's such a fun and a heartwarming movie to watch. So I thought, gee, wouldn't it be great to do an updated remake of Father of the Bride starring Jack Nicholson? That was my first thought. And I thought, yeah, that would work. Anyway, cut to the next day, I have this meeting at Sand Dollar, which is this big... production company, and it was for something entirely different. But I pitched to Carol Baum, who I was having the meeting with. When the meeting was over, I said, let me pick your brain about this. What would you think of an updated remake of Father of the Bride starring Jack Nicholson? And she didn't miss a beat. She goes, can I run with that? And meaning, can I, you know, take it around and shop it around. And I said, well, yes, as long as you leave me in the loop. And that's how it began. But then it has many tales from from there. But I also thought in my mind, if this film isn't as good as the original or better than, what am I going to do? You know, I'll be responsible. But it turned out to be fantastic, and I was very, very pleased with it and sort of honored that I was a part of it.
That can always go either way, can't it, when you do a remake like that?
Oh, well, yeah.
And you were brilliant, and you picked it. You really did.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Take us back to your childhood. Uh-huh. You were born in California.
Correct. And when I was a year old, my mother moved us to Dallas, where my grandmother lived, because my father was an alcoholic, and she was sort of leaving him at the time. And so I was raised mostly in Dallas Irving and my early childhood, and then we moved back. My father came back and begged her, you know, to take him back, which she did. And then when I was almost 11, we moved back to the San Fernando Valley. And so that's the first chapter of my book is titled Texas Valley Gal. So it's all my experiences in Texas, which a lot of actors come from, and I think it's because Texans have big imaginations. They have big everything, but big imaginations, and I think it's due to the flatland. You know, there's no mountains. It's just flat, and I think that your imagination just keeps traveling when you're a kid, especially, and all the nature there. But like in American Graffiti, Candy Clark is from, not Lubbock. I can't remember Arlington. Anyway, she was raised 20 miles away from me, and almost the same situation, you know, same family situation. But
this seems to be innate with you, though, acting, because from a very young age, in your garage theater,
right,
where neighbors would come over to watch you perform,
right,
this was something that you just seemed to have been born into.
Well, you know, I liken it to like an athlete, like someone who is born and they know they can do gymnastics, or a skater who knows that they feel it in their body that they can do a triple Lutz, you know, you just feel it. And you feel your talent, your God-given talent, and you go toward that, you know, from the time you're young on. I believe that. I mean, some people, of course, I'm sure there's exceptions to that. Many, but that's how it was for me. I always, you know, I thought everybody could mimic. Everybody could do little voices. Everybody could move around and make funny faces and be entertaining like that. I thought it was just every human had it. And but like a triple Lutz, you know, not every human, you know, not every person has that talent. But I just went through my whole childhood, just from the time my grandmother got this black and white TV in the 50s. She was the first person on the block to have a television. I just watched anything and everything and took it all in. Like, they had Lucky Strike commercials, but the Lucky Strike commercial was a woman in a box of Lucky Strike. You couldn't see her, but you could see her legs, and she tap danced and had this kind of hat on and the Lucky Strike box, and I was mesmerized by that, as any kid would be. So I tried to, you know, sing, you know, emulate that Lucky Strike commercial, and then everything from, you know, that soap operas to the only thing I didn't like was wrestling. My grandmother was a big fan of Gorgeous George. And the only thing I was fascinated with was he'd take these golden bobby pins out of his golden hair and toss them to his adoring fans in the audience. That fascinated me. But my grandmother loved, she was from Sicily. I don't know, maybe it's Sicilian, you know, she loved the wrestling, and she believed that it was real. Well, so did I when I was a child. But anyway, I would mimic and imitate everyone I saw, Imogen Coca, Sid Caesar, you know, Milton Berle, everyone who come on the Ed Sullivan Show. I just, you know, watch and try and mimic them. So my garage theater was a natch, you know, and we'd have all, my sister and I would write, star in, produce, direct the entire show, and we had these makeshift benches we made out of old trunks in the garage and chairs, dining room chairs, you know, and so all the neighborhood kids would come and they'd bring their pets with them, they'd bring their dogs, and they'd sit and watch these shows that my sister and I would put on.
You were painfully honest in this book about your father's alcoholism, and you recounted how your mother, who worked as a waitress in the evenings, would be gone, and it was up to your father to take care of you. Your younger sister was home with your
grandmother. Yes.
And how your father would go to the bar and leave you in the truck.
Right.
And you were there until he came out and then had to worry about, were we going to get home safely?
Right.
And you recounted how wonderful it was when your mother finally arrived home and you knew it all was well. Despite all of that, it seems to me that there was a really interesting bond between you and your father. And I'm fascinated by people who go through hard times like that. And I think we all have things in our lives. Single one of us. But sometimes you think you're the
only
one.
Whether it's in your childhood or later on.
That's right. So your father loved TV as well.
Yes,
and would often call you into the room, Cindy, right. come see this.
Right. When he was sober, he would. And when he was drinking, he would. He loved. My father was the funniest man I have ever met. And I mean physically funny and just very clever. And like we'd be in his truck and we'd be rounding the bend coming, you know, and we'd see our old house up the road and he'd go, next stop, Poverty Junction. And he would always make fun of our situation, of our family situation, make fun of our mother, of my mother. I remember him saying, I was always afraid because my mother worked at night and I developed this phobia that she wasn't going to come back, that, you know, I was abandoned by my mother, that she was gone. And I used to have I'd go into hysterics and my father would say to me, what's the worst thing that could happen? She's kidnapped. And believe me, once they get a load of her, they're going to let her go in the morning. And so it was, you know, that didn't comfort me at all, but I found it funny. And so, yes, I was sort of left with him, but he had this amazing sense of humor. Amazing. He was so clever, so smart, and I loved and admired him so much when he was sober. When he was drinking, he left. I write about he left and the devil took over, and then it was me and the devil. And that's all there was to it. And I tried to be true to children of alcoholics, which I am one of, in the book, and stay loyal to that and on theme with that. But at the same time, I had to show my father's character as the kind, wonderful person he was, the loving, loving, shy, clever, marvelous person he was. And so there is a dichotomy there, but I wanted to represent both of those things. But believe you me, when he drank, he was vicious, horrible, and it was a dangerous situation. And that I had to navigate until he got back to himself. And it wasn't easy. And, you know, children, when you're young, you have there's no resource you have, nothing you can recount to, you know, give yourself that bravery and that power to navigate that. And so it's just survival. And I wanted to just hit on that. But I could have written out an entire book about my dad and you know, and how I was his little, you know, side commander, you know, to his alcoholism and how that affected me. But that wasn't what this book is about. I wanted to write happy stories about all the blessings and wonderful things that from being on Laverne and Shirley and being in show business that had afforded me. And I wanted to take the audience with me into those happy, happy, wonderful, marvelous moments in my life. I wanted the reading audience to experience it with me, like when I'm waiting tables at the Whiskey A Go-Go and what it was like in the 60s there. And so that's what I set out to write about. And so regarding my childhood, I needed, the hat trick was to make it buoyant and still be honest about it but still make it fun.
What I loved about
entertaining.
It is that you didn't let that define who you are, who Cindy Williams is, and who you could become in life.
Right. Well, except for having the propensity to, you know, being an alcoholic, which I sometimes wonder, although I don't drink anymore, having that gene. I guess I did climb above it, but I took my father along with me. I took his sense of humor. I got that from him. Mm-hmm. And I always respected that and I just adore my father. But that part of him, that devil, I fought, you know, I hated that devil, but you don't fight with the devil. You just have to learn to navigate. And, that's what I did, but I could have written a whole book on that, but I didn't.
Before we
I left it to Suzanne Summers.
Before we get to Hollywood, I want to spend a little time on your mom.
Because okay.
I think your mom was ahead of her time, a woman ahead
totally.
Of her time.
Yes.
She was organic before any of us knew what that
Absolutely.
Word meant.
Yeah.
Tell everyone a little bit about her.
Well, my mother was like, when I was six, I remember her taking, we waited to go to the opening of the first health food store in Dallas. And she took me in there. It smelled awful, like bourgeois gone bad. It was just terrible. And my mother became a Jack LaLanne guru, you know, she became a Jack LaLanne devotee, and she exercised, and this is back in the early 50s, and she watched him, you know, on television, and she always cooked healthy foods and thought about vitamins from the time she, you know, from the time I was six. And so all of, but she could diagnose anything. She had her Adele Davis books and all her, and she had a natural cure for everything. And she could diagnose, too. And she always worked as a waitress, but toward the end of her life in a health food store, very, very prominent health food store in Van Nuys, California, called Bill White's Foods for Health. And I remember her coming home, and a lot of actors came into this health food store because they had a counter and they made like really wonderful food. And so my mother, Steve McQueen and Ally McGraw would frequent the place. And one day I remember my mother coming home from work and she said, you know, Steve, and he loved my mother, Steve McQueen. And my mother came home and she said, you know, Cindy, I saw Steve today, came in and there's something wrong with him. And I can see it by the pallor of his face. And she said, Mary, who owned the store, Mary saw it too. And she just diagnosed, and she goes, there's something wrong with him. And sure enough, he had cancer. And then he'd come in there, and they didn't catch it in time. But I know if my mother had, along with Mary in the store, I know that he would have been better. He could have gotten better. I mean, I know that's crazy to say, but it's the truth.
She had some, again, a gift of...
She did. And you know, she did a Laverne and Shirley. Gary wanted both his mother and my mother to come on because my mother sang and his mother, Penny's mother, owned a dance studio in the Bronx all through their childhood and way up until they moved. And so... The idea was his mother would tap dance while my mother sang Pennies from Heaven and for the Schatz Talent Show on Laverne and Shirley. So my mother worked with Marjorie, Penny's mother, all week. And she, I'll tell you what they did first. The bit was that my mother had... she sang Pennies from Heaven while Penny's mother danced. And Gary came... You know, he watched it during rehearsal, and he came on to the sound stage and said, you know, Francis, we need to add something for you. He said, Rennie, that was a property master, get Francis a couple of wicker baskets we can put on her hips, tie around her. And he did, and he filled them with pennies. And so he said, Francis, when you sing, you know, throw the pennies out. So my mother, when they were rehearsing, she sings, and Penny's mother's tap dancing like this to her side. And she says, when it rains, it always rains. And she goes in her little basket and goes, pennies from, ow, ow. And she kept throwing these pennies up and they kept hitting her. And he said, Francis, to the side, kind of throw them like to the side. But my mother, you know, it was much funnier when she threw them in the air. Anyway, during that week, she got to know Marjorie. And Penny's mother, and I'm sure Penny writes about it in her book, but her mother at this time was talking crazy. And this is back in the 70s. She would talk crazy talk. And, you know, and it was a joke to everybody. You know what your mother just said? Instead of Thanksgiving, it's salt and pepper day. You know, so... My mother, because she had worked with her for a week, said, you know what Marjorie has, Cindy? She has hardening of the arteries of the brain. And what she diagnosed her with was Alzheimer's, which she had. It ended up Marjorie did have Alzheimer's. I mean, not that that's a happy story, but it just is an example of how my mother was ahead of her time. And it was way before Alzheimer's was Alzheimer's. And my mother said, if she just take, and I forget what my mother's remedy for it was, but she said she could open up those passages and connect those, the synapse or whatever it is in the brain. I mean, she knew all this stuff. But she knew the remedy wow. that she, because she looked it up, as I write in the book, my mother would look it up in her health books.
I was hoping she'd break out into song. How was that?
Oh, please, thank you.
How did you meet Penny Marshall?
Penny and I first met on a double date. Our dates were taking us to the Coconut Grove. We hadn't met, and we were going to the Coconut Grove to see Liza Minnelli. And opening for Liza Minnelli was Little Richard. And so this is when there was the Coconut Grove. So we actually met coming into the theater, and we couldn't talk because we were all kind of late. And so we sat and watched this marvelous show. And then after the show, our dates knew Liza, and they wanted, I think she was with Rob Reiner, and I was with my date, Fred Roos. And so we went backstage, and to go backstage at the Coconut Grove to get to Liza Minnelli's dressing room, they were like boxcars. You had to go through one dressing room to get to another. And the first dressing room, Little Richard was sitting in. And so the boys were ahead of us, and they went through to Liza Minnelli's dressing room, and we started walking through Little Richard's dressing room, and he was sitting over here at his dressing table. It was so odd. And as we entered, he puts his leg up like this and stops us. So it's like a toll gate, you know, like this. And he says, "You two, I want to say a blessing over you two." And so Penny and I looked at each other, and we immediately bowed our heads. And he said the most wonderful blessing, because as many of you may know, he is a reverend also. He said this most wonderful blessing over us, just blessing us with all these marvelous, you know, wishes from God. And then he said, "Amen." And we said, "Amen." And he put down, and we kept going. And years after that, and I write about this in the book, one day, I don't know what it was, but I turned to Penny, or she turned to me, and said, "You know why?" No, I said it to her. "You know why this show is such a great success, Penny?" And she said, "Little Richard's blessing." And I said, "Yes." And we've always thought that it was that wonderful, marvelous blessing. And that was the first time we met.
Season 1, Episode 1, mm-hmm. January 27th, 1976.
If you say so.
I think so. Schatz Brewery, Bottle Cappers, and Best Friends, Laverne DeFazio and Shirley Feeney are invited to the boss's nephew, by the boss's nephew, to the Schatz Formal Society right. party. That was the first episode, right?
Yes. It wasn't the pilot, right. but it was the first episode.
Debuting in the number one spot with over 60 million viewers. Did you have any idea how popular Laverne and Shirley would be, Cindy?
No, not an iota. And you know, Donald Trump wasn't even on that show. No, we had no idea. Penny and I thought, because we were, at the time we got the show, we were writing partners together, which I write about in the book. I'm not going to go into that, but that's when Gary called us and said, "I've got a part for two girls who date the fleet on Happy Days. Would you and Penny come, you know, would you and Cindy come over and play these two girls? Leave your job for a weekend." So we said, "Yeah, sure." And this was at a time when I was, well, anyway, doesn't matter. So we go over and we play these characters, and we thought, I'd never seen the show, and I don't believe Penny had either. In fact, I'm sure she hadn't. And even though it was her own brother's show, I didn't own a TV at the time. But we talked about it. We said, well, you know, we read it, and we said they probably smoke and chew gum, and, you know, they're really loosey-goosey type of girls. So we entered during the first rehearsal smoking cigarettes, really smoking cigarettes, chewing gum, and we come on, and we look at each other, and I take her pin curls out of her hair. We'd done that to her, and we fix each other's underwear, you know, like hoist each other up and do that and come on and look around the room. And we were playing Fonzie and Richie's Dates. Richie, is it? Yeah. And we see him across the room, take a drag off the cigarette, flick it across the room and start walking toward them. And Jerry Paris, who was directing the show, said, "What the heck is this?" And he said, "Stop. What are you two doing? This is prime time. You don't smoke and do all this stuff in prime time. This is family hour." We had no idea what he was talking about. But we knew we were going to get fired if we didn't change something. So we went back and we rearranged everything, cut the cigarettes, and just sort of chewed gum and took each other's pin curls out and then saw the boys and crossed to them. And I don't even know. Okay. So when that was the beginning of the show. I mean, when the network saw it and wanted to spin us off, which we didn't know what that was either. But anyway, put that aside. So there was a pilot to the show. Then there's this first show. And Penny and I thought, and the network had said, we bought four on the air. They bought four of the episodes. And Penny and I thought, great, four and off. I mean, that's how we thought. We had no idea. It goes back to that thing of the triple Lutz that I said. Pennies, you know, we had it in our bodies, and we just thought everybody, you know, does this. You know, I mean, it's still one of those things that it was a normal kind of mundane thing that we were doing, and no, you know, we weren't the popular girls in school, so it's going to be four on, four off. So we did the show, and then Gary comes running down the next day and says, 60 million people watch this show, oh my God, you know, and we still didn't get it, and we still thought four on, four off, and then it started snowballing, and we found ourselves on that soundstage for, I don't know, 6 months, without ever realizing that we were popular.
Why do you think it resonated with America?
I think because it was the commonality of human beings. It was Penny and I always, we wanted to make it that the wolf was always nipping at our heels. There was something we were trying to attain up the road. And yet we had to go through all these, you know, these trials and tribulations to get there, to pay the rent, to pay the electric bill, to try and meet a nice fella, to, you know, all that stuff. And at the same time, you know, deal with our own foibles, the things that brought us down. Penny and I made sure that we never laughed at anyone else, that the joke was always on us, because we felt if the joke was on us, the audience is so smart, they'll get it. They'll feel it in their bodies, in their hearts, you know, everything. I know this sounds highfalutin, but that's how we were working the show. And we always made sure, this was the hat trick. We always made sure that it was laugh out loud funny, at least as much as we could make it. And to do that, we always tried to readjust the script when we got it in, add our own stuff, and physically make it funny and bring it up to that thing where we laughed at it. We laughed at ourselves, so we knew it would translate to the audience, and then the audience that was on the soundstage, and then translate to the television audience. And believe me, this is what we were thinking. A lot of people called it that pop-eyed comedy, and we never got kudos for it. And I remember Renee Taylor. Do you know who she is? She was on The Nanny. She played the mother, the grandmother, you know, on her mother. She a wonderful writer herself, and she said, you know, I always loved Laverne and Shirley. It worked on so many different levels. And I was just so, that was such a compliment, because we were doing that. We were trying to be true to the audience. And we'd fight with the writers. We'd say, you know, the audience is very smart. and they're going to play the rest of this joke out in their head, and it'll make it funnier because they see it, and it's going to be funnier. And the other thing we did was we made sure, as much as we wanted to dress in beautiful clothes, which Paramount, the costume department, wanted to make for us, we said, no, these girls don't have beautiful clothes. They want matching sweater sets, but they can't afford them, and we have to stay true to that the entire time. And so Penny and I would, and it was unheard of, that we would take the same wardrobe for the season and just reuse it, you know, rewear it. And they didn't want us to do that, but we said, yeah, because these girls can't afford clothes. So that's a common bond with a blue-collar worker and everybody who wants to achieve something in their lives. There's a goal, and there's the wolf, whatever that wolf represents, at your heels, pushing you on, and you got to make it up over. And that's just a human, you know, just a human triumph that everyone has in their hearts, is to try and make it up over the hill or onto the top of the hill and dream, you know, like that. So also, in the Los Angeles Times, years later after the show was over, all the critics, the art critic, the food critic, the film critic, the television critic, all the critics, the book critic, switched positions, and they each picked something. Like the film critic had he was the food critic. You know, so he had to pick something that he wrote a column, you know, a critique on. The art critic became the television critic, and the art critic criticized Laverne and Shirley and put it in the same terms that Renee Taylor put it in, that it was all these different levels of imagination and emotion, and it wasn't just working as a pop-eyed comedy.
And again, it wasn't just your role as an actor, but you fought for changes, starting with the set even.
Right. When Penny and I were so excited, and we got together, and the day before we were starting rehearsal for the first episode, the episode you were talking about, we came onto the Paramount lot, came onto the soundstage, went backstage first because we wanted to surprise ourselves with the set. And there was no one else there, but the work lights were on, so you could see everything. And we had our own dressing rooms on the set, and we were like, oh! And we had, you know, the costume department, everything. We could not believe this was for us. So we come up the stairs to the back landing where, you know, where we open the door in the beginning of the show where that landing is. But you had to travel stairs to get up there. We throw that door open and we look at this set and our jaws and hearts dropped. It was beautiful. It had wall-to-wall carpeting, gorgeous furnishings, these incredible wall hangings, this beautiful wallpaper, all these little porcelain knickknacks. And we just looked at each other and said, oh, no. And we just immediately took everything down, all the wall hangings, all the knickknacks, as all the little furniture that we could carry, hid it, ran home, each to our own homes, gathered stuff. I gathered a stack of my mother's, why she was saving it, old newspapers. And if you ever look at the set, you'll see them in Milwaukee. They're by the by that landing, movie magazines, my grandmother's old doilies for the couch, and old pillows, and she'd grab 45s and a hammer and nails. And we had pictures of our friends, and we went back onto the set, and we just went to town making it like we would see it. And there was nothing we could do about we tried to rip up the wall-to-wall carpeting, but that wasn't going to be. So we tacked it down. It's called tacking it down as best we could and hid everything that we could and threw old movie magazines on this beautiful coffee table. And the next day, all hell broke loose. And the director of photography, the set designer, the set dresser, the producers, everybody came down onto the stage, and where did you put that Louis VIII furniture? You know, where did you put the? And we said, no, you can't have it like Mary Tyler Moore's apartment. I'm sorry. There's no wall-to-wall carpeting in Laverne and Shirley's life, or Lenny and Squiggy's, or any of the rest of the characters on the show. That's what we strive to attain. That's the comedy. That's the heart of the show. We want to one day have wall-to-wall carpeting. We don't have it now. That's the fun of this show. And we don't have these beautiful knickknacks and wall hangs and this wallpaper. And we made our case. And they took the carpet came up, and and they left all our stuff on the set, and they exchanged out the furniture, and they tacked the wallpaper down. That means they aged it, and but they made us return everything, which we were happy to do. But that's how the apartment became the apartment. And then we had these old hook rugs that we threw down. But we were sticklers about that it had to look worn around the edges. Everything had to look like it had been worn, that we would have gotten our furniture from the Goodwill. We would have made, you know, what you make in college, the brick, and although they didn't go to college, the brick and, you know, the 2x4s, you know, for shelves. And we just, you know, we made our case.
What happened at the end of Laverne and Shirley?
Well, coming into the 8th season of the show, I had, I'd gotten married and pregnant. And so coming into the 8th season, and everyone knew I was pregnant. I was 4 months pregnant when we came back. I assumed that they were going to hide me behind furniture and our grocery bags, and then we do these, I've forgotten the term now, but anyway, shows where I'd be in the beginning of the show as I got, you know, bigger and bigger, I'd be in the beginning of the show and the tag. You know, I'd say, well, I'm going to, you know, the cheese festival. I'll see you later. And I'd leave in the beginning, and then the rest of the cast would do the show, the main bulk of the show. And then I'd come in on the tag, back from the cheese festival. Got samples for everybody. And that's how I thought the season was going to go. But I was wrong. I was the first woman, I believe, on the Paramount lot to be in a series, and I was pregnant. And the bosses didn't know how to, they didn't know how to handle it. And when I got my contract for that 8th season, it had me working on the date I was due to deliver my baby. And I said, there might be a problem here. I mean, it was an actual show on that date. And argued back and forth and back and forth. And then it got into this big brouhaha. And so it ended up, because they weren't going to relent. They wanted the schedule to be the schedule. And so it just, you know, it just turned out that it was better that I leave and that they go on. And then they did the final season. And I was happy for it. Everybody was happier for it.
You've collected a lifelong group of friends throughout all of this. And it seems like you've stayed in touch. Have you stayed in touch with Penny?
Oh, God, yes. She just texted me and said, happy birthday, my dear friend. I miss you. And I said, my birthday is on the 22nd, not the 2nd. I always stay at her house. And she's like, you know, once you, I can't explain it. But she's just like my sister. You know, I mean, she's a family member. And we just... years could go by, and Penny and I could walk into a room together, see the same thing at the same time, and make the same comment about it. And that's just the way we've always been, and that's the way we'll be until the day we die. And I go over to her house all the time. We sit in her big bed and watch her big television. You know, we like the same shows, except the NBA draft picks. That, I was over there a couple of weeks ago, and I walked into her room. She keeps it freezing cold. And I said, what are we watching here? And she goes, draft picks. And I said, what letter in the alphabet are they up to? She goes, that's not how they do it. And I said, I'll be in the kitchen. Call me when you're done.
Ed Begley Jr., who wrote a foreword for your book, lifelong friend of yours as well.
Yes.
Why did you never marry him?
Because
he loved you.
Yes, he's like my brother, and always has. I'm his daughter's godmother, and he's just like that. I mean, I could never, you know. I mean, The first thing, when I first met him, the first words out of his mouth were, "Will you marry me?" I think I write about that in the book. But he's just my dear, dear, darling friend. And it just wasn't, you know, just was one of those things. And he's my darling friend to this day. I mean, well, he wrote the foreword for the book. And then, what did I ask him? Oh, well, he's just, you know, I mean, that's another person that, you know, he'd walk in that door and I'd say, hey. You know, I mean, he's just like family to me.
How about Ron Howard?
What about?
Have you? Oh, yeah, I should clarify that. Have you stayed in touch?
Oh, yes. When I was writing the book, I needed to get his approval for some of these pictures that I was putting in the book, and I wanted to tell him what I was writing about him. And so he was in London doing a movie, and so his assistant said, well, you know, I said, just ask him, you know, because he doesn't need to call me or anything. But indeed he did, and it was like an hour on the phone where we just went up and down memory lane. And he said, you know, Cindy, we have played everything together, every kind of couple together. In fact, I played his mother once on a show called Insights. But he was a baby. This was kind of a religious show that the Catholic, it was, oh, I forget the father's name, the Monsignor's name. But anyway, it was
Father
produced
Fraser?
By the Catholic Church, okay. Kind of. And it was on, and Martin Sheen was the producer also. Anyway, so in this show, I was a teenager who was pregnant and about to have a baby, but I was ill. And Ron was my son in heaven talking to, I don't know, Saint Peter or someone, and one of the saints. And he was deciding whether he was going to live or die. I mean, he didn't know if he wanted to be born. So it was kind of this moral, you know, with this teen. So I played his teenage mother. And in the end, he was born. But so he was talking to me about, you know, we played mother, son, we played girlfriend, boyfriend, wife, husband, once, high school sweethearts. We did this movie together called The Migrants, where I played this girl that, you know, he and I run away together or talk about it. And so he was saying, we're kind of like, Tracy and Hepburn. And I said, yeah, right. And I think they could have, done that Happy Days episode as good as well as us. And so I just talked to him right before I did the fabulous person. What you see is what you get with him. Just the nicest guy, you know, everybody's good friend, lovely, lovely, wonderful, inspiring human being.
Such a great read. I highly recommend Surely I Jest. It is the story of Cindy Williams. We're going to open up questions to the audience. Tim Grimes from the Ann Arbor District Library has the microphone in the back there.
So what's going to happen is we're going to set up a mic right up here. And if people could just come up to the mic, and we have plenty of time for questions. So please don't be shy.
While someone's getting up, you mentioned Hepburn and Tracy. I want to tell you we have a little bit of old Hollywood here today. And if Virginia Patton Moss would be so kind to stand up.
Hey.
Yes, please. From It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh,
she starred in It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh,
what a treat.
She's from Ann Arbor, lives here, raised her family here. So.
Wonderful.
I live here.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Nice to have you here, Virginia.
Ann Arborite.
Go ahead, please.
Hi. Cindy, you were speaking beginning about how you had suggested Jack Nicholson be in the remake for Father of the Bride.
Uh-huh.
I was wondering why that didn't happen and why it went to Steve Martin instead.
Well, I got the script to Jack because he's a friend of mine, and it sat on his desk because he was going, I forget what happened, he never got around to reading it, and he apologized to me, and by then, you know, they'd moved on. Richard Dreyfuss was a they were interested in Richard Dreyfuss and I can't remember who else, but I mean Steve Martin did a marvelous job, as Jack would have done, but it would have been a different movie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I have seen a lot of the stuff you were in. I loved you in The Conversation. You were doing your scenes, I believe, with Frederick Forrest, weren't you?
Yes.
Ah, okay, my memory hasn't gone.
Excellent.
Travels with My Aunt with Alec McCowan and Maggie Smith. I think, yeah, Louis Gossett Jr. was in that.
That's right.
But I'm going to bring up one you probably, the small part you had in Beware the Blob.
Oh, yes.
Everybody starts somewhere, and I know that, I know it was kind of a spoof. It was directed by Larry Hagman. How was that any fun at all, or was it just...
It was loads of fun, and I get eaten by the blob in a drainpipe in Glendale. And it was just so much fun, especially with the marvelous Larry Hagman directing. It was just, it was like summer camp to do that movie. But that was it. I get eaten like on page 28 or
something.
Yeah, I
think
something,
you were like in a sewer with somebody and the thing comes down.
Right, and I say, the scene, the only scene I had is my boyfriend is playing the guitar and we're sitting in a drain pipe, this big drain pipe, and he, you know, one of those big drain pipes. And he's playing the guitar and I'm sitting there with him. And a cop comes, and he says, "What are you two kids doing here?" And we get up. I don't know if my boyfriend was smoking, you know, marijuana or something. I don't remember. But he's, like, going to arrest us for something. And so we get up, and then the blob starts coming behind the cop down the drain pipe, the opening of the drain pipe. And my line was, "Oh, mister, what's that behind you?" And he says, "Oh, no. You don't. I'm not going to fall for that one." Something like that. And then there's a scream, and you hear guitar strings being eaten up, and that was it.
Hi. Hi, my name is Litt. I just want to discuss one of the major social issues of our time and see your response to it. Which is homelessness in America. I'm wondering, first of all, if you're familiar with one of the papers. It's one of the more innovative ways that sort of combats the problem, which is the street paper. They're sold by people who are experiencing homelessness and can't get into mainstream employment, you know, because of lack of access to showers and laundry and storage and that sort of thing. And they're in a lot of the major cities. I'm just wondering what you think. Had it been in Milwaukee at that time, and Laverne and Shirley had gone into the city, Milwaukee, or downtown where they're generally sold, what do you think? Do you think they would have purchased it and been a part of it and gotten the paper?
Absolutely. They would have they would have had to put their, you know,
because I know they had meager earnings. Yeah, they had meager earnings. And,
right.
You know, a lot of people who get it in this area, you know, are not necessarily wealthy, but it's to engage the society with, you know,
right,
and some of those issues. So,
and it's a comfort and a support and a saying yes to somebody. And when I was a little girl in Texas, there was a man who sold, a black man who sold papers in Dallas on the street. He sold pencils. And my mother used to let me, you know, she waited tables downtown at this place called Town and Country. And so she'd take me to work every now and then and let me go to a movie. And I remember this man, and he was just so sweet. And I said, I was about 8 or 9, maybe a little older. And I said, "I'd like to buy one of those papers." And he said, "Oh, miss, this is a black paper. You wouldn't want this paper." Little girl, he called me. And I said, "Yes, I do. Yes, I do, and I want a pencil, too." And I just love the whole idea of it. And so I'm saying this because, yes, Laverne and Shirley absolutely would have done that and supported it, absolutely. Awesome. And there needs to be more of that. They need to take that and make it something bigger for people.
Yeah, it's only been here for 5 years. It's actually started in America in 1989, you know, a little bit How long did the show run? I remember.
It ran for 8.5 years.
8.5 years. Yeah. So probably by then the show
was gone.
Was gone.
Yeah. So exactly. It wasn't
right.
But see, we would have gotten into trouble with that person somehow. That's how they would have written it.
Yeah, I'm sure of that.
Come home. We'll sell the papers too.
Yeah.
For you. Yeah. You know, we'll have a little business, exactly. And then all heck would have broken loose.
Yeah, I got it. And secondly, we do have a writer here. I don't know if there are any restraints from one of us interviewing you before you leave.
Oh.
We're getting a picture.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank
Our paper's called Ground Cover.
Ground Cover.
A marvelous production that they do.
Hi, big fan of Laverne and Shirley. Just wondered what you kept from the set. Do you have Boo Boo Kitty?
I do. Yeah. I didn't have him for a while because there was only one Boo Boo Kitty. I write about how Boo Boo Kitty came about in the book, but there was only one Boo Boo Kitty, and so they kept him under lock and key because we didn't have duplicates in case something happened to him. Someone stole him, and after the writers started writing him in the shows as a character, he became muy precioso. So they'd lock him up. So when I left the show, he was still under lock and key, but the property master, Rennie, one day I was working at Warner Brothers, and he was too, and he said, Cindy, meet me in front of the commissary at, I write about it in the book, at lunchtime. So I met him, and I see him come up the street, and he's holding the cat. I start crying. So I do have him at home. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. First of all, thank you for coming today.
It's my pleasure, really.
So, couple of quick questions, if I could, just two questions. First of all, American Graffiti is my all-time favorite movie. I just absolutely love it. You know, George Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola, and just an unbelievable cast, including yourself and so forth. You couldn't have had any idea how that was going to, I mean, it was unbelievable what you got out of that. Can you talk a little bit about the process of how you got the job and how it became and so forth? And then the second question was about the physical properties, physical comedy that you did in Laverne and Shirley. You and Penny did a lot of hard physical kind of stuff.
Right.
Where did that come from, and how did that develop? And
okay, well, American Graffiti, we had no idea what we were doing. I mean, I got the part by it's a story, but I have it in the book, but. The important thing is, I think, and the interesting thing is, all of us, from Harrison to Richard Dreyfuss to Candy Clark, Paul LaMatte, all of us thought we were doing just a hot rod movie. We had no idea, because it was shot in 28 nights. It was very low budget, no dressing rooms, no hair makeup. So we just thought we were in like a Roger Corman low budget, you know, hot rod movie. And we liked George, but we thought of him as a, you know, he was just one of us. And then 2 weeks into the movie, which is half of the production time of the film, George invited us to San Francisco where the editing bay was, because we were shooting in Northern California up in Modesto and, up there. And he invited us into the editing bay to see a 20-minute assemblage with music. And after this was over, our jaws dropped. I won't even tell you what Harrison said. He just said, this is brilliant. He used an adjective, but he said, this is brilliant. And I just couldn't believe it. And we all knew we were in something that was a treasure. We all knew it. It was so beautiful. And as far as the physical comedy goes on Laverne and Shirley, it was just a natch for me and Penny. But they wrote it the first season just for her because her brother knew she was capable of that kind of goofy, you know. And I kept saying, I do that. I do that. I want to do that. Let me do that. And he just, you know, would push me aside. And finally, I must have worn him down. And so Gary came to me and said, I'm going to write you something physical to do, and we'll see how you do. And so what he wrote was, we're cleaning, and Penny's looking at the vacuum cleaner, and she gets it. She looks like this at the, you know, she takes the brush off and looks down the hose, and she gets it stuck on her mouth. Yeah. And then I come into the room and see it, and she's going, woo, woo. So I tried. They wanted to see how I'd get it off of her. And so I tried. I knew that all I had to do was unplug it. But I put my foot on her chest and tried pulling and taking it this way, pulling it over my shoulder, and did all these things. And in the end, I pulled the plug. But Gary said, okay, you win. And so that's how the physical comedy for two women.
You seem so natural. Had you done much physical comedy?
No, I hadn't. That's it. I wanted to do it. I had done it in at church camp for the talent shows, and I'd done it in my garage theater. But I never got to do it. They always cast me as the lead's best friend or the weeping girlfriend or the ingenue. And I kept saying, I want to play the comedy part. And there was never a chance, if you think about it, where else on television or in films could a woman do physical comedy? And, now you have... her name escapes me. I'm so sorry. She's brilliant. Melissa McCarthy, thank you, who's brilliant at it. And there are a few others who are brilliant at it. But that's how Penny and I got to it. I mean, her brother recognized it in her and wrote to it. And then I just, I campaigned to do it because I knew I could do it too.
Who influenced you?
Imogene Coca, Rosalind Russell, Cary Grant also. I mean, there were men who influenced. Joan Davis, mm-hmm. Which nobody knows. And I guess, people ask me about Lucille Ball, but Lucille Ball, brilliant, brilliant technician, brilliant physical comedian. It wasn't like our show because ours was in tandem, and we played it a little differently. That Lucy was always in control, Lucille Ball, brilliantly so. Yeah. But anyway.
That was wonderful.
Thank you. Hello, Cindy. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Holly.
Hey, Holly.
Watched your show back in 74, did it come in 76, but later because I worked in a factory like you and Laverne. Just want to tell you that.
The beer factory?
No, it was making dinettes and welding.
Same deal.
Yeah, well, we had to ask permission from the supervisor in the welding shop when the women want to go to the bathroom. We had to wait until he let us to go. This is how it was in 74.
Yeah.
But getting away from that, did you ever like the show they had, Joni Loves Chachi? I remember that.
Very interesting.
Very interesting.
Holly.
Not as good as your show, I know.
I never saw it.
Really?
Because they were shooting while we were shooting.
I only watched it once or something.
Really? Well, they were next door, and I love them both.
Yeah.
And we never got to see it or even watch it being shot because we were shooting next door.
One last question. Uh-huh. You think we'll ever see you on Dancing with the Stars?
Oh my God.
Great idea.
Oh. I have... the weakest angle. I watched the show. The show I wanted to do, the reality show, was The Apprentice.
Oh!
I wanted to do that show, but my feet are not as good as my brain. I mean, as far as like trying, I'd be out on. I would just crumble to the ground on the first step. When I did my audition for cheerleader in high school, on the downbeat of my routine, I sprained my ankle.
Oh, my
so
God.
I just don't have strong ankles, but I would love to, I don't even want to try, but in my mind, I watch them, I go, could I? No. How about that? No. I could do a cha-cha.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Holly.
Welcome to Ann Arbor. I was wondering if the city of Milwaukee has done anything to honor you in Laverne, and if not, why not? Much like Minneapolis has done for Mary Tyler Moore.
They made us honorary bottle cappers. Milwaukee made us honorary members of the union. And they've always been very, very sweet to us. So, yes, but they did honor Henry Winkler. By the river there, they have and we were all there for it, the Happy Days cast and the Laverne and Shirley cast, for the unveiling of the bronze faun down by the river.
And also, I was wondering, you seem so familiar, you seem so Shirley-esque to me, and it feels... very like I said, familiar and friendly. I was wondering if you could tell me what part of Cindy's personality is most like Shirley and what part of your personality is least like Shirley?
Well, I always call situation comedies personality plays, because if you watch them, the writers will, I mean, they start with a character, but then they see how the actor or actress performs it weekly, and so they start writing to their idiosyncrasies and their, you know, their strong suits and their, you know, their failings, and so I am a lot like Shirley, in because I played her through me, but there were the idealistic thing about wanting the doctor husband and the, you know, and the house wasn't me, because I wanted, you know, I wanted to do what I was doing. So that wasn't me. And also they wrote a turn in the show that they watched me and they wrote this thing where Shirley can be really sweet. Do you remember Mrs. Kolchak? The she was the deaf woman. Rose played her. She was deaf, and I thought Shirley thought she was deaf and got really angry with her all the time. And so they played this beat where I go, Mrs. Kolchak! And Penny would say, she's not deaf. Yes, she is. Mrs. Kolchak! And so they'd have Rose play, that was the actress who played her. She'd go out of the room and she, and they had this thing where Mrs. Kolchak hated Shirley. And so there was this thing where Shirley wasn't always the nice person, because Shirley didn't like Mrs. Kolchak either. And they just had these turns for me where I'd be like really sweet one minute, and then I'd bite somebody's head off and turn and say, that's not it! And then I'd turn back and say, as I was saying, I wanted, you know. And so they, you know, and I'm kind of like that because I'm Italian. And I can scream and yell one second and then just turn around and say, what did you want for lunch? And so they did write that, but I was more like Shirley than not.
Thank you. It's an honor to meet both aspects.
Thank you.
I'm afraid at which one I'm going to get.
Oh. No, I won't yet.
My name's Lori Wilson, and this is my daughter, Daisy.
Hi, Daisy.
She is probably one of your younger fans.
Yes.
My father is your age. He's here, too. So you've got three generations of fans. And Davey became a fan when she saw you on a Nickelodeon show where you boxed Penny Marshall.
Uh-huh.
Remember that? Sam and Cat.
Sam and Cat.
She's telling me. She's whispering what I should say.
Uh-huh.
She's my official person here. But anyway, so I was just wondering how do you feel about being such an amazing inspiration to so many different ages of people?
Well, it's a blessing. You know, I mean, it's a blessing. It was a blessing to be on Sam and Cat. Mm-hmm. And when Penny and I, you know, I never watched the show.
Right.
I had acted on one Nickelodeon show way back when.
Okay.
But it was, the girls were wonderful, and the cast was wonderful. But they were like, Penny and I were shocked because they were all so excited that we were there. And we were like, you know, can you believe this? That, you know, we were kind of shocked. And and then shocked more when, you know, there's like an audience out there that, like Daisy's age, that, you know, saw the show and appreciated it.
Right, yeah, because she's 9, and that's the age I was when I started watching Laverne and Shirley.
But here's the difference. When we came to do that show, they wanted us to have a fight, and they put boxing gloves on us. And we said, this
like
is
real
not
deal
funny. We want to fight like this.
Right.
And they wouldn't let us, and Penny got really upset. So, and we were so tired. I'd just gotten off the road doing 6 months in a play.
Okay.
And she had, I forget what was going on with her, but we showed up there, and she, so when we blocked the scene, the physical fight scene, she goes, I'm sitting down. I go, what do you mean you're sitting down? I'm going to just sit down and let you bite my ankles. And I said, and to be honest, I fell down in one, and I had to have like two of the crew help me up. I couldn't, my knees had gone. So it was quite different than the old show.
Yeah, but fun still, right? Yeah.
Pardon?
But fun still.
A lot of fun. Yeah, mm-hmm. We had a lot of fun.
That's good. Good to hear. Well, thanks for coming.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Daisy, for the question and for watching the show.
Hi, my name is Tricia.
Hi, Tricia.
I first wanted to thank you for talking about Ron Howard because I've always had a huge crush on him, and I would have asked if you hadn't already talked about him. I was wondering if you also were back then or are still friends with Henry Winkler.
Oh, yes. I see Henry all the time. Wow. Yeah. We were good friends. And, and I see him all the time. All the time.
Yeah, I've heard he's super nice, too. So
super
he would
nice.
Be my second crush after
super nice
Richie
guy.
Fonzie,
so. We've been at these places where we sign, they're big, big autograph shows together. And he taught me one thing. Like, if there was a line, and there would be lines around the block for Henry, he will go out while people are waiting and shake everybody's hand and go and introduce himself to everybody online. And where I just stand up and I go, "Hi, everybody! We're here!" And but that's how nice a guy he is.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
My question already got asked. I wanted to know who got custody of Boo Boo Kitty. But also, I wanted to know, I know that with Laverne and Shirley being written off of Happy Days, Mork and Mindy also was, taken off. Did you ever get to meet Robin?
Oh, I know Robin.
You knew Robin?
Yeah. Because, you see, Paramount, the lot in those days was like a big college campus. So our soundstage was next to Happy Days, which was next to Mork and Mindy, which was next to Taxi and Bosom Buddies, and everything was there. So I'd see Robin. I was telling somebody this morning, and, I'd see him walking on campus. I'd say, "Hey, Robin." And he'd turn, "Oh, Cindy, hi." I go, "Robin, it's just you, me, and Esther." And no one gets that, and he never got it. But it was I was referring to Esther Williams. And so I was thinking, I'd always think of all the Williams that I'd say, "It's just you, me, and Anson." And he'd go, "Oh, yeah." Every time I'd see him, that's what I'd say. "Hey, Robin, it's just you, me, and Esther." And he never got the joke, ever. But he'd go, "Oh, yeah, yeah." So one time I was at, years later, I took my kids to George Lucas's 50th birthday party. He invited, everyone and their families. So I'm with my kids, and Robin is, he's got a backpack, and he's going through it, and I'm by this popcorn machine. So I see him, and I go, "Hey, Robin." And he turns around. I go, "It's just you, me, and Esther." And he looks and goes, "Oh, yeah." And my kids say, "Oh, it's Mrs. Doubtfire." And he does this. He goes, "Oh, children. Oh, hello, aren't you lovely? Oh, look at you, too." And he does Mrs. Doubtfire for 5 minutes with my kids. So that's what kind
that's,
of a guy.
That's funny. I woke my oldest this morning up. I went, "Hello." And she goes, "Mrs. Doubtfire." But I also wanted to thank you for being Shirley Feeney. I am also a child of an alcoholic, so I can totally understand. I had a really crappy childhood, and I always looked forward to Tuesday nights because it was Happy Days and then Laverne and Shirley, and you guys were one of the few happy things that I have.
I totally understand.
So thank you so much, and tell Penny thank you.
I will.
And why didn't Carmine and Shirley get married?
Well, it was my blessing, believe me, and I'm so happy because, there were shows that did that for me, too.
Yeah, you guys, you're like an icon for me. I'm sitting over there with my husband, and I'm rocking back and forth, and, I'm fangirling all the way, and I'm like, because I'm thinking of my older daughter going, "Mom, you would never be a fangirl." But thank you so much.
Thank you very much. What's your name?
My name's Julia Blades.
Thank you, Julia.
Thank you, Cindy.
You for that.
Good afternoon, Ms. Williams. Thank you for sharing yourself
Cindy.
With us today. I teach an undergraduate course here on music and movement, and I use American Graffiti as one of the final studies because of George Lucas's beautiful, brilliant use of music with scene design. And I teach a class that is 90% female undergraduates. And your character, every year after year, your character comes up as the one most discussed because of the sexual tension between you and your character and Ron Howard's character. And to young undergraduates, to young undergraduates, this world is, that world of American Graffiti is so alien.
Right.
And they asked, did people really behave that way?
Really?
And I say, talk to your grandparents, because it would be their grandparents' generation. But your character, I just want you to know, your character always brings about the most discussion among the young women in the class.
Wow. Well,
so thank you.
Well, thank you for that. Those two insights. George Lucas, before we started shooting American Graffiti, he had Ron, he had every character, every person, every actor into his office discussing the characters. But one of the things he said to Ron and I went in together, and he said to us, I see this movie is a musical because the music will never stop during the entire film except when the source of the music is gone, i.e. the car. You know, it's crashed or the car radio or it's been stolen. And we thought, I remember Ron and I left his office and said, a musical, brilliant. So that's great that you're doing the class like that. And for insight to music in a film, because it is a musical.
Yeah.
So that's like brilliant on your part. And the other thing is, during the movie, you bring up the sexual tension. Ron and I did not, I'd never had a screen kiss before or anything, and this called for like getting, you know, felt up. And so we were out of our minds crazy, you know, with anxiety, Ron and myself. So I suggested to George, I said, what if we just go down in the seat off camera and play the scene? And George said, okay. And so if you ever watch the movie, which you have a million times, we go out of frame and play the dialogue down in the, you know, on the seat. And that's how we got around the sexual tension.
Well, it brings up the most discussion with my students. So thank you.
That's good to know. Thank you.
Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
So you're Italian. My name is Vincenzo.
It's
Vincent, actually. And as a matter of fact, my daughter Lydia, my wife and I, we've known Lucy Ann for quite a long time. She's also Italian. But my daughter and I each have a question for you.
All right.
Go ahead first.
You mentioned... this thing's on. You mentioned earlier about going to see Liza Minnelli, but you got caught stopped halfway by Little Richard. Yeah. Did you actually ever get to talk to Liza or just your boyfriends?
Did we get in there? I don't remember. We were so stunned. I think by the time Little Richard was finished with us, they were coming out because I don't remember meeting her. And but I've met her over the years, but and she's wonderful. And she was marvelous this night, and so was he. But no, I don't remember getting in there.
All right. Well, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Hi. My question is a little more serious. I just wonder, was it difficult for you to accept a role working in a brewery when you had seen the effects of alcohol, overuse of alcohol so closely in your family?
That's very interesting. No. You know, I don't know. It was something that I never really grappled with deeply until I wrote the book. I just put it aside. And I remember the first time I ever thought of alcohol as something really that shouldn't be, you know, put up there on a pedestal out in the public forum was Suzanne Somers said to me, did you see Sinead O'Connor say... because Suzanne Somers is also the child of an alcoholic and wrote a book about it and called Keeping Secrets. And she said, Sinead O'Connor said after she won the Grammy, now I'm going to go out and get stinking drunk. And she said it like it was a badge of courage. And it offended Suzanne. And it's the first time I ever thought of that. And I thought, yeah, she's absolutely right. It's a weakening thing. It's something that, you know, really needs to be taken more seriously than to just, you know, be cavalier and say, now I'm going to go out and get stinking drunk. And so she brought that up to my attention, but never on Laverne and Shirley. I didn't see beer as an enemy or anything like that, or the devil. I still don't. I think people who aren't alcoholic can, you know, enjoy their beers or their glasses of wine. I just can't, and neither can anyone in the DNA pool in my family, because it's something else. It means something else to us, or in Suzanne Summers' family.
Okay, very good. And just thank you very much for having grown up with that sense of humor and not become embittered, as could quite easily have happened.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm bitter. I'm angry. I gnash my teeth.
Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Just pull that mic down for yourself.
For some of us shorter people.
Yeah.
And I, too, am Italian. I have the same personality where I can go eat each way.
Uh-huh. Go
but,
off.
I just wanted to kind of say two things. I wanted to just thank you for being here. And I just moved to Ann Arbor. I'm not an Ann Arborite. Like you called it. I just moved here 16 days ago, so this is like so exciting.
Wow.
Because I've never.
From Italy?
This is like my first time with a celebrity, like the whole thing, so I'm just like so excited. I can't wait to tell my family back in Jersey. So, one of my questions is. Do you travel to Jersey? Because I know my family would love to see you.
Oh, yeah. I have what I like call my Jewish family in Jersey.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, all the time.
So
I love New Jersey.
So where would I be able to, like, how would I be able to find you? Because I actually, no, I'm
saying. I'm here!
I mean, like, is there, like, a web? Because you know what's funny? We just came to the library because my kids are in the Minecraft upstairs. And my husband's like, you want to see Shirley from Laverne to Shirley? And I'm like, yes!
So I was like, isn't that something? Well, you're starting off well in this town.
I know.
I mean, you're off to a great start
like
in this town. I'm everywhere all the time.
Do you have, like,
your
own website? Like, just look up, like...
Do I have a... Like, you know, I'm so... Bad. I'm so computer
illiterate. Yes, you do. You do have a website.
I do. And we try to keep it updated.
It's fabulous. It's up to date. I looked at it today.
Oh, that's Trina. She must be doing her job.
This is CindyWilliams.com. This is CindyWilliams.com.
Okay, cool.
And she's on Facebook and Twitter, and they do a great job with that. Just look for Cindy Williams on social media as
well.
Thank
you.
But because of you, I am going to make sure that my schedule's up there, because it just rung a bell in my head. That
no, I
know
that,
that
they would love to see you, and like you said, it just was a fluke for me, but I'm very excited.
Thank you.
So.
What's your name again?
Michelle.
Thanks, Michelle. Thanks. Say hi to your family in Jersey for me.
Welcome to Ann Arbor. You're going to love our town.
Yes, you are.
I will.
And speaking of Michigan and Ann Arbor, this isn't your first time to Michigan. First time to Ann Arbor, but you've been to our state before.
Oh, I love Michigan. Yeah, I'm always in Rochester for at the Meadowbrook Theater for plays there that I do with Eddie Mecca.
Right.
A lot, yeah. Oh, Tim.
Hi. Yes, it's Tim again. We hope to see that woman back at the library, because you never know who's going to be down here in the multi-purpose room. That's just about all the time for questions. But I know Lucy Ann wanted to do something at the end.
Well, this came up as a theme today, your Italian heritage. It's not just Italian, it's Sicilian.
Correct.
Which is distinctly different
when
you think about it. And we had here in town, he passed away several years ago, but his family is still here, the Balestri family. And Joseph Balestri is known as being the very first person to translate Sicilian to English and English to Sicilian. And even the Pope requested his dictionary. So we have a copy of the book for you from his family.
Thank you, Lucy Ann. Thank you. Thank you. You know, my grandma, who I write about in the book, spoke no English, but she was a true American. She came over through Ellis Island, and my mother was born in Manhattan right off the boat, and this means so much to me. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You've been a fabulous audience.
Thank you,
just
everyone.
Just wonderful. Thank you.